Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, continuing with a historian, Nick Bunkert, his new book, In the Shadow of Fear, America and the World in 1950. The quote from Bertrand Russell, all at present, all except the most thoughtless, live under the shadow of fear. It is January 1950. These events, among many, the Korea bill is defeated in Congress. The B-36 is in abeyance as a plane that's too slow and will be easily shot down by the MiG-15 just introduced in Moscow. The president approves research for the superbomb, the H-bomb. The USS Missouri, the last battleship in the fleet, runs aground because they mistake buoys in Virginia. Everybody laughs at the president. That, of course, is where the peace deal was signed in 1945 in Tokyo Harbor. And Carl Mundt and Joe McCarthy and take advantage of an event that we're going to go to right now. January 25th, Manhattan, the courthouse, and the way Nick presents it is vivid. A tall, elegant-looking couple, she in a green dress, approach the courthouse for sentencing. Who are they, Nick?
Wow, these are Alger and Priscilla Hiss. And what had happened was that Alger Hiss had been convicted a few days earlier of perjury. He had been convicted of perjury in his testimony to a federal grand jury a couple of years earlier, relating to allegations that he had passed documents to the Soviet Union when he was a State Department official in the 1930s. So January 25th, 1950, having been convicted, he then comes back to the courthouse to be sentenced, and he's sentenced to 5 years in prison, actually two counts of 5 years in prison, but to run concurrently with each other. And the Alger Hiss affair had been rumbling on for some time. I mean, the allegations about him had been first made right back in 1948, but this was the moment when the affair kind of exploded in the American popular mind, American popular consciousness, because this was the point at which the Republican Party seized upon in Congress the Alger Hiss case to support the contention from Robert A. Taft that Washington was full of communist subversives. And it was in the wake of the conviction of Alger Hiss and the sentence of Alger Hiss on January 25th that Senator Joseph McCarthy began his own anti-communist crusade along the same subject.
Inspiring, but McCarthy's speaking at West Virginia, and he makes the same speech at Reno, I learned from Nick. That is not as critical as what happens in the Senate later that month. Carl Mundt stands and are nearly, well, I picture the Senate as being deserted, and Mundt speaking to a wall about Alger Hiss and the conviction. At the same time, Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, a man who is extremely well-educated and very well-dressed and proper in his double-breasted suits, for reasons that I can only imagine a novelist could solve, decides to make a statement about how he believes, how he will always be, how he will stay forever close to believing in Alger Hiss. Why did he do that, Nick?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. Now, let's remember that Alger Hiss and Dean Acheson did know each other very well. They'd worked together in the State Department. In addition to that, Alger Hiss's brother, Donald Hiss, was a partner in the same Washington law firm where Dean Acheson was a partner. So they knew each other very well. And Dean Acheson had a very high opinion of Alger Hiss, as many people did, in terms of the diplomatic work that he had done during and after World War II, particularly the work he had done in the creation of the United Nations, its first session in San Francisco. Now, I think the reasons why Dean Acheson did what he did was really, first of all, because Dean Acheson had very high ideals about personal conduct and loyalty. Having been a friend of Alger Hiss, the two men having worked together, given that Acheson had respect for him, he was not prepared in any way simply to let Alger Hiss be thrown to the wolves, if you like. So that was one issue. I think also there's a genuine issue that Dean Ashton very genuinely disliked the kind of tactics that the Republican Party were pursuing in terms of turning the case of Alger Hiss into a cause celebre. But I think there's also another issue, which was that at this particular point, Dean Ashton felt that he was personally in a very strong position. He had an exceptionally good relationship with the president, and most of his foreign policy initiatives that he was involved in as Secretary of State were actually going pretty well. Ashton had a great big success in the autumn of 1949, which was the creation of the Federal Republic of West Germany. Ashton had been very instrumental in the creation of the Federal Republic of West Germany, which had had its first elections and had its own government. That had gone very well. NATO was starting to move. NATO was starting to develop. And in many areas, Ashton felt he was making great progress. So putting all this together, he felt confident enough to be able to make those comments about Alger Hiss.
At a press conference, Karl Mundt is unaware of this press conference. He's speaking against Hiss. McCarthy rises. The drama here is incredible, Nick, really. McCarthy rises and immediately attacks Acheson's statement. And he goes on and on and on attacking Acheson's statement. There's another man that we need to introduce here, a Democrat, the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, Lucas from Illinois. What do we need to know about Lucas and how he handled McCarthy?
Well, as you say, this was the moment, January the 25th, when the McCarthy era really began. That was the moment at which McCarthy stood up in the Senate and put himself right at the front ranks of the Republicans in this campaign of theirs to alleging that there was a communist conspiracy that infiltrated Washington. That was the moment where it all began. Now, in the succeeding weeks, McCarthy then pressed on. He pressed ahead. He gave the very important speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, early in February 1950, which he made the allegation that released 56 card-carrying communists inside the State Department. He then repeated that speech again, as you said, in Nevada. And then he took his campaign to the Senate floor. McCarthy essentially demanded the rights to speak on the Senate floor at great length, in fact. He spoke for something like 5 hours on February the 20th, 1950, in which he detailed a whole list of allegations about the presence of communist subversive Communist Party members, both inside the State Department and other parts of Washington. Now, at that point, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader was a chap called Senator Scott Lucas of Illinois. And it was up to him to confront McCarthy and to try and put an end to all this and try and stop McCarthy in his tracks. And unfortunately, Scott Lucas found that extremely difficult to do. And this was really the point where things really started to go badly wrong for Harry Truman, because Lucas really wasn't a very confident or authoritative leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate. Lucas, as I say, he was from Illinois. He had been chosen as majority leader because he was seen as being kind of a unifying figure. He was pro-labor union, but he was fiscally quite conservative. He was although he obviously represented Chicago as part of Illinois, he was actually from rural Illinois himself. He seemed to bridge all these different kinds of worlds, and he was thought of being someone who could bring together the Southern Democrats who were conservative with the Northerners who were more liberal. That was what Lucas was what people thought his talent was, being a kind of unifying figure. But in fact, he found himself completely outgunned and outmaneuvered by McCarthy. He simply couldn't cope with the sheer aggression of McCarthy's tactics and McCarthy's inventiveness and McCarthy's stamina and resilience to be able to keep on his feet for 5 hours, coming out with allegation after allegation, tying everybody up in knots. And that was Lucas's problem. Lucas, in the succeeding months, found it impossible to get all of his Democrats on side to attack McCarthy. And he also made a critical error. This was a hugely important error historically. Scott Lucas agreed that they would appoint a Senate subcommittee to investigate McCarthy's allegations about the State Department. Now, the moment they did that, the moment they announced that there was going to be a committee that was going to investigate McCarthy, then effectively McCarthy had won, because McCarthy then had a platform within which he and his allies elsewhere in the Republican Party could harry the president on these issues to do with the alleged communist infiltration. He had a platform, he had a stage, if you like, and he could keep the business going. Now, what the Republicans wanted to do at this stage, as far as I can see, was they wanted to keep the controversy in McCarthy started going until the primary season, because it's an election year, the primary season in May and June and July, and then to keep it rumbling on as long as possible into the autumn until it would affect the midterm elections in November. And that's effectively what McCarthy succeeded in doing. But a lot of that flowed from this mistake that Senator Lucas of Illinois made by allowing there to be a subcommittee which investigated McCarthy's allegations, because during those subcommittee hearings, the affair just grew and grew and grew. The scandal became more and more and more a public. There was a huge amount of public interest, and McCarthy's reputation, far from McCarthy being, if you like, laid low by the Democrats who were able to find flaws in his arguments, on the contrary, McCarthy actually became a very well-recognized national figure. This is where he became famous.
Nick Bunker is the author. The book is In the Shadow of Fear, America and the World in 1950. We need to get back to Moscow watching Washington. And a speech made by the Secretary of State, Mr. Acheson, that may or may not be critical to understand the attack on Korea in June of 1950. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one-size-fits-all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.